Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. There has been two traditional tracks in studying the ancient world, the first being the ancient scripts that have survived the test of time. And those are very helpful, but obviously limiting because people who wrote them at that time, just like our time, are biased and they are told according to the author's own interests, sort of like the saying, history is written by the victors. Now, the second track, well, in the past 100 years, has been archaeology, which is also incredibly helpful to help tell the story of the ancient world. It's helpful to get to find the tools, the pottery, the building structures, all these things that we can glean a lot of information from. But these objects obviously don't talk and thus are limiting in themselves in what they can teach us about the ancient world. Now, there will always be a lot that we will never know about the ancient world. It's either lost due to time or purposefully destroyed. In fact, that will be our conversation on Monday. I hope you can tune in for that. But there is now, really in the past decade or so, a third way of learning a lot about the past. And it's a scientific way that uses advancements in climate and genetic sciences. And our guest today, Kyle Harper, has done a deep survey of this science to weave a story of how climate change, in part caused due to major volcanic activity during the ancient world, and the prevalence of pandemic diseases associated with the development of cities help play a major role both in the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire. Kyle Harper is a professor of classics and letters and senior vice president and provost at the University of Oklahoma, and he is the author of the book, The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. Kyle Harper, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thanks, Mitch. The pleasure is mine.
Now, you are a historian of the classical world, so why is it you decided to go down this third track, the scientific track of explaining?
Well, I study the Roman Empire for a living, and even though it's the ancient past, and you might think that we know more or less what we're going to know about the ancient past because we're limited to the histories and the documents that happen to have survived— in fact, we're learning new things about the ancient past all the time, from new ways of reading old texts to new archaeological discoveries that help us understand the ancient world in ways that we couldn't have imagined. And I think, in particular, we live at a time when different scientific disciplines from the natural sciences are opening up new horizons on the ancient world that even 10 or 15 years ago were almost inconceivable. And so in my own work, I've benefited greatly from our contemporary efforts to understand the climate and the Earth's history of climate change that is obviously a very urgent contemporary issue, but one that has unexpectedly created new knowledge for those of us who are interested in the human past. And secondarily, genetics. The genes are a kind of window into the history of life, and that's true of humanity, but it's also true of the microorganisms that we share the planet with. And genomes are opening up, again, a kind of new archive that we simply didn't have before. So we're learning more about the ancient past, and it's changing the way we understand it. It's changing the way that we even would answer some really big questions about the way the world was thousands of years ago.
Is this a third way of diving into and discovering the ancient world, one being the writings that still exist from the ancient world, the other being archaeology? Is this a third path?
I think that's a good way to think of it. And people who are interested in the sort of things that I'm interested in are often allied with archaeologists and others who've really studied the material record. But I think it all has to be synthesized. And in my book, I invoke E.O. Wilson's idea of consilience, the idea that different domains of knowledge leap together. That there really aren't separate domains of reality, and so ultimately, any domain of knowledge or any discipline for acquiring knowledge is just a different way of trying to come to an understanding of reality. And so I think that humanities, social sciences, natural sciences all have different approaches. They're different disciplines, but they're most powerful when they're allied with one another.
climate and disease does go hand in hand, and we're going to talk about that. And I guess my first thought about climate change in the Roman Empire is like, well, you know, we didn't have the Industrial Revolution yet, and all the toxins that have been put in the air. But at the same time, when I think of the Roman Empire, in one manner or another, it could be argued existed for 2,000 years. So I guess it would be quite natural for it to experience significant climatic changes.
Sure, and you get at something that's really fundamental, which is that human economic systems and human exploitation of fossil fuel sources of energy over the last 150 years, more or less, have drastically altered the atmosphere's chemistry in ways that are rapidly changing the Earth's climate system. So that anthropogenic climate change is the reality that we are experiencing and grappling with. But every climate scientist recognizes that there's also natural change and variability in the climate system. And so there are other forcing mechanisms, whether it's volcanic eruptions or changes in the way the Earth, for instance, orbits around the sun, or changes in the amount of radiation that the sun itself is emitting, that are natural sources of variability. Now, those have operated on different time scales since the beginning of the Earth. And precisely because we need to understand how human alteration of the atmosphere is changing the climate, it's important that we understand that natural background. And so that's where a lot of our new evidence has come from. Now, it doesn't diminish the importance of modern or contemporary climate change to say that the climate is always changing, but it actually helps us understand the really long story of humanity's interaction with the climate. The climate has been a major factor throughout human history, and the Roman story, which, as you say, unravels across several centuries, really over a millennium, of course it experienced changes in the climate. And we're just now at the point where we're starting to really see where some of those major points of change were and how the Roman society both at times succeeded and at other times struggled to come to terms with a changing physical environment.
For background here, what's important to know about the current climate epoch that they're living through, the Holocene?
Well, the Holocene is the climate period of the last 10,000 years, give or take, and it is a very favorable, relatively warm, and extremely stable period of the climate. And so the Holocene has been a climate period that's almost exactly synchronous with sort of the history of humanity as a major force on the planet. It's the Holocene that is the background to the rise of agriculture and that is the background to the rise of human civilization. So in many ways, although we have a long period of human history in the Pleistocene as a hunter-gathering species, it's the Holocene that has been sort of our home, that has been the at least the home of human civilization. And so that background is very important to understand really the entirety of the history of human civilization. And now that we're playing with the Earth's atmosphere in ways that really threaten the kind of basic stability of the Holocene climate regime, it opens major questions and very, dangerous questions about what it means for human civilization.
Let's get into the rise of the Roman Republic, Roman Empire, and tell me about the Roman, what you call, and maybe others, the Roman climate optimum. This is 200 BC to 150 AD. So this encompasses the development of the Republic, the fall of the Republic, and past Republic with the Empire. What's important to know about this?
Well, this is that term that you use, the Roman climate optimum, is one that's actually come into general use among paleoclimatologists to describe a period of several centuries of later Holocene climate history that really are coincident with the rise of Rome to becoming a powerful and historically significant civilization. In the book, I try to draw some boundaries around this period based on different studies of the Earth's past climate to show that really the Roman climate optimum is a period of climate history extending, as you said, from about 200 BC to maybe the middle of the 2nd century AD. And those centuries are the same period when Rome manages to conquer the Mediterranean and become the dominant power in the greater Mediterranean, and then to build one of the most extraordinary empires in human history. And it's a period when the Roman population booms. It's a period when the Roman economy flourishes. And during this entire period, the physical climate is in many ways the backdrop for that success. It's a period of really unusual and marked climate stability. So it's not a period when the climate is extremely variable from year to year, decade to decade, based on comparisons with the last several thousand years. It's a very stable period. And it's also a period when a range of proxies suggest that the climate in the area where the Romans built their empire was warm and wet. And so it was very conducive to agriculture. And the Romans, as you mentioned, are a pre-industrial civilization. So agriculture is the foundation of their economy and their society. And it seems like the climate was a factor in the Roman success. And so when you think of how the Romans built this exceptional empire in terms of its stability, its power, its demographic and economic success, there are many factors that explain that. There are human factors. Romans are famous for their legal system, and they're certainly extraordinarily capable political and imperialist regime. But part of their success, at least, is also environmental. And the climate, I think, we can see as a kind of co-conspirator in the Roman imperial success.
And towards the end of this Roman climate optimum is when we get what Edward Gibbon, who was the 18th century chronicler of Rome, the rise and fall, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. This is what he called the most happiest time of the Roman Empire, also known as Pax Romana or Roman peace. This is when we get the reign of five emperors, ranging from Trajan to Marcus Aurelius, and people are still familiar today with Marcus Aurelius as somewhat the philosopher king.
Right. The second century has long been recognized in many ways as the peak period of the Roman Empire, and it's the period of the greatest population expansion, the period of the greatest economic expansion, in many ways the period most characterized by peace within the frontiers of the empire itself. And it's a really classic and enduringly challenging question. Why does this end? What happens? Seemingly quite suddenly, the Roman Empire moves from a period of its greatest peace and prosperity into an age of really manifest crisis, when it experiences difficulty in protecting its borders, when it experiences demographic and economic difficulties, when it has trouble fielding the same kind of army that it had before. And it's something that generation after generation of historians have tried to answer. And it remains an enduring mystery, an enduring puzzle. But I think we can now see that the environment is a part of that story. And it would be difficult to explain in full what caused this transition from the age of Roman dominance and Roman prosperity to an age more characterized by crisis and challenge, without taking into account the role of the environmental change, the physical environment, the climate, as well as the biological environment and the rise of new diseases and new kinds of biological challenges.
This is a period of time that's called the late Roman transitional period, from 150 AD to 450 AD. What kind of changes were happening in the climate at that time?
Well, there's several centuries where the climate is simply less stable than it had been in the preceding centuries, and you have strong interdecadal variability. And so you'll have several decades that are very warm, and then several decades that are very cool. You'll have several decades that are very arid, and then several decades that are very humid, alternating. And so it's a period when the Romans, really down at the basic level of the peasant or the farmer, were constantly trying to adapt to the swings of the climate from one extreme to the next. And so there's a period of climate disorganization. And the Roman Empire is able to adapt to many of these challenges. And by no means are the Romans immediately overwhelmed by environmental variability. But it's clearly there as a new dimension of challenge as the Roman Empire is trying to cope with all of the ordinary challenges of running an empire. How do you keep a emperor sitting on the throne without succumbing to his rivals? How do you keep the enemies who are across your frontier at bay? How do you raise enough taxes? Running an empire is difficult under the best of circumstances. So the environment's only one factor among many. But it does seem to have been a several centuries of relatively great variability in the climate regime before the onset of what's now being called a little ice age at the end of the period that I'm talking about, when temperature swings suddenly and very dramatically because of a series of what we now understand to be major volcanic eruptions that force the climate into a seriously cooler regime that lasts for over a century and that is really part of the kind of final catastrophe of the Roman Empire.
I would imagine when we were talking about the rise or the fall of any empires, there are always multiple explanations for it, and they can all be true, and it can always be a combination of many things. But I imagine if you think about the environment and climate, and if there are changes to climate and the environment in general, that certainly would add stressors and could either make things more favorable or less favorable.
Exactly. And you know, the environment is part of the story, but doesn't mean we have to throw out the window all the traditional explanations and all the things that we certainly know are part of the challenges that the Roman Empire faces. Those are political, and it depends a lot on who the emperor is and to what extent the emperor can maintain legitimacy and stave off civil war, which is an important source of weakness for the empire. It depends on the empire's ability to raise taxes, to pay its army, to fend off its enemies. So we know a lot of these elements of the story are still as important as ever, but we now have this new knowledge that I think we have to take into account when we try and explain something as complex as the fall of one of the great empires in history.
And of course, agriculture is so important in this story. Tell me the importance of Africa, Northern Africa, I suspect Egypt, which was considered for the Roman Empire really the breadbasket for the empire.
That's right. And the Roman Empire stretches from the Atlantic deep into Mesopotamia, into the heartland of what's now Iraq. It stretches from far northern Europe all the way to the Sahara. And the North African provinces are really an integral part of Roman imperialism, and they ultimately become deeply Romanized, and that's true from Morocco to Egypt. And Egypt is incorporated into the empire in the reign of Augustus, who's considered the first emperor, and quickly becomes just a linchpin of the entire system. It's fertile agricultural system based on the Nile River inundation that floods the valley every year and produces exceptionally fertile agricultural regions, is important to the food supply of the city of Rome and to the food networks of the Roman Empire in general, and really becomes just an integral part of the Roman Empire and remains so down until the Arab conquests of the 7th century. So North Africa in general and Egypt in particular are really fundamental to the Roman Empire.
And what happens there then? Does just the land dry up? Is something to we might recognize more like today?
Well, no, Egypt is really a unique ecological region because it is extremely arid, and so it receives very, very little rainfall. But it's dependent on the flooding of the Nile that is draining the runoff of the monsoon rains that drench the Ethiopian highlands every summer. And so Egypt has always been, in historical periods, very, very arid, but dependent on the Nile flood. Now, in modern times, the flood regime's, of course, been controlled by the Aswan Dam. But in ancient times, it was more or less uncontrolled and depended annually on how much rain Ethiopia got. And so there was always a certain amount of variation from year to year in how high the Nile flood would be. But it was still, for most of the early period of the Roman Empire, exceptionally reliable. And it seems like the Romans depended on Egypt during a period when the Nile flood was extremely regular and dependable. In the later Roman period, for reasons that are still incompletely understood, although it's possible that actually El Niño's had a role in this, because the El Niño Southern Oscillation is really the dominant mechanism of climate variability in the Pacific and deeply influences the amount of rainfall that Africa receives. But for reasons that are, as I say, though still not totally understood, it does seem that the Nile flood becomes somewhat less dependable and more erratic in the later centuries of the Roman Empire. So it's a really fascinating sort of global story about how the Roman Empire's deeply entwined with the global climate system.
And then what happens? Does the empire then struggle? Are there food shortages? What happens then?
Well, of course, over such a long period of time, there certainly are periods of really acute food crisis. And I try and reconstruct one that is particularly significant in the middle of the 3rd century as the Roman Empire enters a phase of really deep crisis. We know that the food supply around the empire had failed over the course of several years, and then the Egyptian harvests start to fail in the middle of the decade of the 240s. And this could not have come at a worse time. The Roman Empire is facing a range of external threats, and then all of a sudden it doesn't have the food to feed its population, or just as importantly, the food to send to its armies. And so food crisis played a major role in the onset of this kind of empire-wide, all-encompassing crisis that besets the Roman Empire in the middle of the 3rd century. So I'd say yes, that food crisis could at times be a major trigger for other kinds of crisis, political crisis, military crisis. Food crisis could spawn humanitarian disasters, what we would think of as migration crises. So food is dependent on the environment, and the environment is variable and changes, and that can have enormous and very unpredictable ramifications for human societies.
We are in conversation with Kyle Harper, professor of classics and letters and senior vice president and provost at the University of Oklahoma. He is the author of the book, The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. And we are going to get to disease in a moment, because they do go hand in hand, climate and disease. But I just want to sort of get this structure in place and clear. There are three different time periods that we're talking about. The Roman climate optimum that went from 200 BC to 150 AD. And then we get the late Roman transitional period, 150 to 450. And then the late antique Little Ice Age, from 450 to 750. What was that about? What was happening there?
Well, this is a really interesting part of the paleoclimate story that has come into much greater focus in recent years, thanks to the great work of scientists who are studying ice cores and the history of volcanic eruptions and the history of climate change in general, who've helped piece together a story of really extraordinary precision. And we now know that in the year 536, and this is attested as well in a range of written documents that we've known for a long time, so traditional Greek and Latin histories, for instance, that tell us that the sun disappeared for a year and a half. And the year 536 is a year without summer. It's now possible to locate that volcanic eruption in the ice core records of the Northern Hemisphere. And then about 4 years later, there was a second tropical volcanic eruption that again spewed sulfur into the atmosphere that turns into sulfates that effectively reflect solar radiation away from the Earth and back out into space and cause abrupt and dramatic cooling. So major volcanic eruptions like this, in effect, provide a kind of screen in the atmosphere that forces instantaneous cooling. And for instance, in more recent times, the 1815 Tambora eruption, we know was a major volcanic eruption that had immediate effects on the global climate and triggered harvest failures and food crises around the world that in turn had all sorts of extraordinary political and social ramifications. And these eruptions in the late antique period were even larger, and the fact that there was a sequence of them seems to have triggered a kind of cascading effect. And so what happens in the 536 and 540 eruptions is an episode of global cooling that seems to have been the most extreme cooling event of the last several thousand years. And this has been recorded in a range of tree ring studies that show that the climate just suddenly and dramatically was colder. And so this was clearly an immediate challenge to not just Romans, but probably human societies worldwide, who were forced to grapple, first of all, with simply the terrifying event of the sun disappearing and appearing dimmed for such a long period of time in a world without the same kind of scientific explanations that we have. But then, more consequentially, the harvest failures that followed. And this episode of volcanic eruption seems to have produced not just a kind of transient cooling, but the onset of a really enduringly cold phase in the late Holocene climate. And so the next century and a half are one of the coldest phases that we know of over the entire Holocene. And this cooler, more unfavorable phase in the Earth's climate is the backdrop for the sort of final acts of the Roman Empire, the final collapse of the remnants of the Roman Empire.
And this creates great amount of movement from large bodies of people.
That's right. It really does seem to have been an event of global magnitude, and to have it's very likely that it played a role in what we know of in this period are major movements of not just kind of bands of raiders or raiding parties, but really entire peoples that must have been desperate for food and desperate to survive, and are therefore willing to move their entire society's great distances.
You write, Attila the Hun may have even been a climate refugee. But first, just for, I mean, everybody recognizes the name Attila the Hun, but just quickly tell us who Attila the Hun was.
Well, the Huns are an interesting and still somewhat mysterious group of steppe nomads. So they inhabit the Eurasian steppe. They're not, their economy, their society is not based on cultivation or agriculture, but is based on nomadism. So the rearing of livestock that are moved seasonally across the arid grasslands of Central Asia. And all of a sudden, in the later 4th century, this new steppe nomadic people show up on the frontiers of the Roman Empire. And it's long been recognized, including by the Romans themselves, that this is really an inflection point, that things are really different after the Huns show up. It's not that the Huns ever actually managed to conquer the Romans, but they seem to have forced several of the Germanic societies who were living peacefully beyond the Roman frontier into a really profound crisis that forced the Germanic societies to desperately try to enter the Roman Empire. And it seems that the Huns themselves may at least in part have been moved by major episodes of drought that are increasingly coming into view from the paleoclimate records from the middle of the 4th century. So even with the arrival of this new steppe nomadic society in the mid to late 4th century, there is very plausibly a climate dimension to their motivations to migrate west.
And we talk about the Huns. This is where we get the name for the country Hungary, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's right, although that's a slightly later migration. But it's, you know, they're famous for, most famous for wrecking the Roman Empire and causing such havoc in the later 4th and 5th centuries, particularly under the leadership of Attila, who builds this massive empire that does stretch across part of what's now Hungary.
So do you think the term climate refugee is appropriate?
I think it's not inappropriate for some of the Huns who are moving in the later 4th century to think of them as climate refugees who are being moved in part by the desperate circumstances of drought in the 4th century. And then again, I think in the 6th century, when you start to see, again, massive migrations, not just of Germans, but also of Slavs and Turks, in the mid to late 6th century, that we're very likely again seeing the impact of global climate change in forcing massive people movements that really are what we could think of as climate refugees.
Yeah. And I imagine this is just creating a lot of stress on the empire itself, because not only does it have to deal with a large movement of people and people trying to come in or people looking for land or whatever it may be, they're probably also dealing with their own food shortages or just other issues that this late antique little ice age would cause.
Yep, exactly.
And then let's not stop there. Let's throw in the Justinian plague.
Right. Well, we have to talk about disease, and to me, that's in some ways the even more exciting part of the story. And we're learning so much that I think we couldn't almost have imagined that we would know about not just how the Romans lived, but how the Romans died. And it turns out to be a very important part of the story of the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire is a period of human history when we start to see that human societies experience what we would call pandemics, that is, interregional disease events. A pandemic like the flu pandemic of 1918 that is a worldwide episode of mass mortality caused by the influenza virus. A pandemic is a global or at least interregional disease event caused by some kind of infectious germ, a bacterium or a virus that causes an infectious disease. And in the Roman period, we see that the empire experiences disease events on a scale that had perhaps never happened before. And the first of these pandemic strikes in the 160s, so the height of the empire, it's a pandemic known to historians of the Antonine Plague. We don't know with certainty what caused it, although the leading hypothesis remains the smallpox virus, and I think that's the most convincing explanation we have so far. Disease events of this kind of magnitude recur several times over the next several centuries and culminate in a disease event that was the most impactful pandemic up to that point in human history, without question, the Justinianic Plague. It strikes starting in the year 541 AD, so this is quite late in the Roman Empire's history, in the reign of the Emperor Justinian. In this case, we have now no reason to doubt the identity of the germ that caused such destruction. It was what we could call true plague, the plague bacterium. Scientific name is Yersinia pestis. It is the bubonic plague. It is the same germ that caused the medieval Black Death in 1347 to 1351, which is maybe more famous, maybe the most famous disease event in all history, the Black Death. But the Justinian plague is caused by the same germ. And in fact, many of the same patterns are exhibited in the 6th century. A disease event that begins with the importation of a new germ into the Roman Empire that is able to spread with terrific speed across the interconnected roads and seaborne exchange networks of the Roman Empire, and to kill an almost unfathomable number of people. It's a truly horrific bacterium, and although we don't have the same good kinds of census records that we might for a more modern period, or even the same kinds of records that help us piece together the mortality and the Black Death, our most reliable and vivid witnesses describe the death toll in the capital of the Eastern Empire, in Constantinople, and suggest that something like 300,000 out of 500,000 inhabitants in the city died in the space of a few weeks. And so we know from the Black Death that this biological agent is in fact capable of killing something like half of an entire society in the space of a few weeks. And there really are, throughout history, very few biological agents that are capable of that kind of destruction. But the Roman Empire was struck at this particular moment by what deserves to be considered the worst killer in all of history, the plague bacterium. And the Roman Empire, I think, was really never the same after experiencing that acute demographic crisis in the 540s.
Yeah, throw that in again with being in this late antique little ice age and the pressures, especially at the outskirts of movement of large masses of people because of climate change. I mean, it just seems like the recipe is there for something that has lasted so long as the Roman Empire to fall.
Right. The double blow of abrupt climate change triggered by the volcanic eruptions of this period that may have some more or less direct link with the plague. We don't know exactly what caused the plague to break out at exactly this moment, but I think most historians who work on this feel, and I certainly do, that it's not mere coincidence. In some way, the abrupt climate change caused, through some sort of ecological trigger, the outbreak of the bubonic plague. And so it was a double blow, but it wasn't purely coincidence that you happen to have this really millennial scale climate anomaly along with this equally anomalous mortality event in the outbreak of the plague.
And civilization or cities even, these things go hand in hand with pandemic diseases, don't they?
Right. The Romans' civilization, the way the Romans lived, created the ecological framework for the spread of diseases. And high population densities with huge numbers of often or usually very poor people living in really awful housing conditions with relatively primitive means of sewage and sanitation, undernourished in many cases, were really an environment that was very conducive to the transmission of diseases. So the Romans created the ecological context that led in some ways to the diffusion of the diseases that were so important in their downfall.
Looking at how this happens, and I guess roads are also an important aspect, right, in spreading it.
Exactly, and the Romans are famous civil engineers. They're famous for their roads and aqueducts and buildings, and the road network that connects the Roman Empire and that binds together this network of cities and binds together the regional economic production of the different provinces of the Roman Empire also binds together the disease environments of the Roman Empire. And so the roads are a force of connectivity that is in general positive for Roman development, but can also be a source of danger and in many ways are also a source of the transmission of the diseases that laid low the Romans.
It's towards the later years of the Roman Empire, where we get the rise of Christianity, eventually even through the empire itself. It's just a little bit of time after what we consider the fall of the empire, but I don't think there's ever this moment of like, okay, yesterday the empire existed, today it does not anymore. So just a little time after what we consider to be around the time of the fall of the Roman Empire, we get we also get the rise of Islam. Do you see a connection to climate and disease with the rise of these two religions, Christianity or Islam?
Well, sure. I don't think it's too outlandish to see at least two different kinds of pathway that the environment did influence the rise and diffusion of different religious movements, and in this case, think particularly of Islam. One is that the spread of Islam in the 7th century takes place at the expense of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire really folds in what were then its most important and flourishing provinces in the Eastern Mediterranean with really extraordinary speed. And I think the only way that the Roman Empire's rapid collapse in the face of the Arabic invasions can be explained is by seeing it as already demographically and economically weakened. And the Roman Empire, by the 620s, 630s, 640s, by the time the Persians and then the Arabs conquer the Eastern Empire, was already extremely diminished from where it had been even, say, a century before. So the sort of political and imperial consequences of the environmental demographic changes, of course, influence the course of history. And then the other is that, and I argue this in the book, that both Christianity and Islam, actually, as well as Judaism in this period from the later 6th and 7th century, and the 7th century for Islam, develop in a very apocalyptic atmosphere. And you don't see a huge emphasis on apocalyptic ideas in, say, the 5th century. But from the 6th century, when you have these extraordinary environmental events like the volcanic eruptions, and then particularly what was clearly this simply inexplicable and traumatic experience of the plague, where a disease would wipe out half of a society in the blink of an eye. And to people living through it, it seemed like the signs of the apocalypse. It seemed like that the end of time was at hand and divine judgment was being passed. And so you see Christianity and Judaism in the aftermath of the plague pandemics take on much more apocalyptic tones. And I think even Islam is influenced by that cultural atmosphere. And Islam at its very origins has very strong apocalyptic overtones. So the environmental background does shape the cultural atmosphere. It doesn't mean that those ideas had to take shape or that they were determined by the particular sequence of physical and biological causes, but they're part of the atmosphere and they're part of the story of the religious cultures of the period that we know as late antiquity.
Well, you begin your book, Kyle Harper, The Fate of Rome, with sort of towards the end of this story with Pope Gregory, who was Pope from 590 to 604 AD, who you would write seen was living during a time that we consider the end of time.
Right. He's one of the most extraordinary popes and really a major figure in the development of the papacy as it takes shape in the early Middle Ages. And his entire worldview is clearly suffused with the experience of these human traumas of climate change and above all of bubonic plague. And he certainly thinks that in some ways the time is drawing to an end and that the final judgment is approaching. And his entire worldview is really, I think, unimaginable without understanding the reality of this context of somebody who was a bishop leading a group of believers through this almost unimaginable imaginable trauma. So I think as historians, we should try and be sympathetic and understand the experiences that shape the worldviews of people in the past. And someone like Pope Gregory, I think his world is hard to imagine without us understanding the role of climate and disease in the world that he knew.
Again, just thinking about how long the Roman Empire, in one form or another, whether it was from Byzantine or just its early developments in today around Rome, again, close to spanning to 2,000 years. I mean, just how long the United States has existed. It's just a fraction of how long the Roman Empire lasted. And even in our, you know, less than 300 years that the United States has existed, people probably for a good period of this time feel like, okay, we got this thing handled. We this thing's normal. We have conquered nature. Now, and I don't know if people are thinking that today anymore, but I imagine there are definitely times during the Roman Empire where they feel like they had conquered nature. This is the new norm. This is how things are going to be and how things are always going to be.
Well, it's easy as humans to think that and to assume that the world we inhabit is stable. And I think the story of the Roman Empire, despite its really extraordinary success and longevity, is a reminder that even this eternal empire was, of course, fragile and finite and came to an end in ways that the Romans didn't foresee. And I think that there's something deeply human in that reminder that our world will be changed in ways that we can't predict or foresee, and no political regime lasts forever.
Yeah, and all the stressors that are going to come. Kyle Harper, I've enjoyed our conversation very much. I thank you.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
Again, Kyle Harper has been our guest. The name of his book, The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire.